Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Lauren Chulgen, and this is The Exchange. Well, it was the dance move seen round the internet. New Hampshire Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer raising the roof during President Donald Trump's State of the Union address. She and her Democratic House colleagues seem to have a lot to celebrate this term. They're part of a historic number of women serving in Congress, and they're in the majority. And this is the first time Custer's been in the majority party since she was elected in 2012. But how much power will House Democrats really wield in Washington? And what does that mean for big issues like immigration or the controversies swirling around the White House? Well, Congresswoman Custer is here in studio today and will be hanging out for the whole hour. And we want to take your questions about Congress, the 2nd District, 2020, whatever's on your mind. Send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can post on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. That's all in one word, NHPR Exchange. Or, of course, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Well, Congresswoman Custer, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for coming in on this lovely morning.
Great to be with you, Lauren. And yeah, it's a beautiful day.
Yes, of course. Nice snowy morning. We're used to it. So we got a lot of things I want to dig into this morning. So like, let's just get this State of the Union thing right out of the way. I kind of want to recreate that moment, if you will. So first, can you remind us why so many women, including yourself, were wearing white that day?
Sure. Well, we do have a lot to celebrate. It's been 100 years since women earned the right to vote. And we have now 102 women in the House of Representatives. And we wanted to make sure that the American people could see that visually. So my friends and I made a plan that we would wear white because we knew it would stand out on the television. And then we got the word out to everybody. We did invite our Republican colleagues, and they chose not to. The sad part of this story is that there are only 12 Republican women left in Congress. Fewer than past years. But we're very excited that we have 90 Democratic women, and we wanted everybody to be able to see that visually. So that's how it started. It's a big scrum. We have to save the seats to make sure we're all sitting together in a block.
I was going to say, because I always wonder that, you know, why and how do you end up all being together?
We plan it, and then we have to go there at 6 o'clock, and we have this big thing. We're saving seats, and then
like
there are rules
game.
About how you can save the seats. And some of our men were very supportive, and they wanted to sit with us. And we said, well, we love having you as colleagues and supporters, but you can't sit with us because it'll block the visual.
And so for most of the speech, it seemed, you know, things were pretty status quo. You know, the president would say something. Democrats would often sit. Republicans would stand and applaud. But then we got to this moment. Let's just take a listen.
Annie, raise the roof, Custer.
Raise the roof and break that glass ceiling.
So that was the after effect.
That,
of that
was
moment.
The after effect.
So let's listen to. Let's go back to the beginning and hear what the president said.
No one has benefited more from our thriving economy than women, who have filled 58% of the newly created jobs last year.
And so. At first, you're sitting there, you're clapping, kind of, and then all of a sudden, like, there's a wave of it. What happened?
So, this is funny. At first, we were sort of clapping, like, it's great that there are more women in the workplace, and hopefully they're getting good jobs. Then what happened, actually, it was Kirsten Gillibrand was sitting down in front of us, Senator Gillibrand, and she turned around and started pointing at the new women in the Democratic caucus. And we have 40 new women. So it's dramatically expanded the number, almost doubled the number of women. And many of them have been in the news. And so it was just sort of a joke that, yes, there are more women in the workplace. They've taken these jobs from Republican men.
Well, obviously, that wasn't quite probably what the president was intending to say. And in fact, afterward, I think he said, you know, you guys weren't supposed to clap at that or whatever.
Right.
And so, of course, as you heard, then the moment was parodied on SNL where they did this bit about women of Congress. There was like a 70s Charlie's Angels vibe.
Then he took it the next step. He had a whole, there was a whole section of his speech. I don't know who was writing it, because then he tried to take credit for this big new wave of women in Congress. And he had another line in the speech right after that said, there are more women in Congress than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we stood up and did the raise the roof. It's like, no, you're not going to get credit for that. And maybe he should get credit. Maybe they're there despite him. But so then that's where the parody came from.
Well, that is an interesting point. I mean, it's a kind of a funny political line we walk now when we talk about women in Congress. It seems like for Democrats, you know, you can say it's a celebration. We have more women. But what you're saying earlier is you also want to see Republican women. So how do you balance those
two? I want the American people to understand this story. I keep wishing that C-SPAN would pull back and give a bigger picture. Because when we're sitting there every day in Congress, and by the way, we can sit anywhere, but in our caucus, on the Democratic side, it's a complete diversity of America. We are now over 40% women. We very high numbers of African Americans and Hispanics and gays and all different kinds of people. And on the other side, honestly, it feels like a Rotary Club meeting back in the 1960s before there were women in Rotary. There are literally a dozen women left. And I grew up in a Republican family. I think the country would be better served by more diversity in both parties.
And so your raise the roof moment, where did that come from? That was just like your celebration of women? Or
well,
why
as one of my nieces wrote in, she goes, I recognize that move from dancing at the weddings.
No.
I guess it's from the 1990s, and maybe that was the height of my cool.
I mean, did your sons like text you immediately when it was on SNL? I mean, like, what, were you surprised? Were you watching?
Totally. No, I wasn't watching. I slept right through it. But the next morning, my inbox was filled with texts. Completely surprised. 100% surprised. And they thought it was really funny.
And
they said, Mom, that's a real milestone.
There you go. Well, if you impressed your children, I mean, what more do you want?
What more do you want?
So your brief internet fame aside, I mean, what were some of your big takeaways from the State of the Union?
Well, to be honest, what's funny about that moment getting the attention is that I think it was partly in contrast to the rest of the speech. The rest of the speech was very flat, as he would say, low energy delivery. He had some nice moments where he was honoring veterans and honoring young people, but most of the speech was really wrapped up in this message that he was forcing at that point. I mean, mind you, we had just come off the longest government shutdown ever in the history of our government. It's a pretty low bar to be president of the United States and keep the government open. And he is so fixated on this campaign promise of a 2,000-mile-long wall on our border, our southern border, that he really can't seem to focus on anything else. And the fact of the matter is that Congress, both Republican and Democrat, do not agree with him on that. And now we've all signed off on this continuing resolution. There is some funding for some fencing at the border that's recommended by the Customs and Border Patrol. But in terms of $5 billion or $7 billion or whatever number he chooses, they are not willing to appropriate that. And that is a bipartisan agreement. And large numbers of Republicans joined us in the vote to end the shutdown and fund the government.
I want to dig into immigration a bit later on, but sticking with this kind of new Congress vibe, so to speak. I mean, you've been around now for, this is your fourth term. You've seen a lot of State of the Unions. I mean, could you tell me, there's a lot of coverage of how these new members are changing the vibe in Washington, or they're pushing politics to the left. Can you give us a sense of how this term is different in your perspective, if at all?
Sure. Oh, no, totally different and very exciting. I think the last 2 years have been hard. They've been hard on everybody. I mean, they've been hard on my constituents. They've definitely been hard on me and my friends. And it was hard in Congress to have the energy and the fortitude every day as, you know, government shutdowns or not letting certain people into our country or just hate and vitriol that I find hard to live with personally. And hard to explain to my children, to my family. To I have 8 grown nieces, and to say, our democracy will survive. Our Constitution is strong. So when we won the election in November, through tremendous hard work all across this country, and a group of my friends and I had been very, very involved in recruiting these women candidates, recruiting young people, veterans. We have people from the CIA, from all different backgrounds, from business backgrounds and legal backgrounds and healthcare backgrounds, fighter pilots. You know, these women are extraordinary generation. They came up through with Title IX since kindergarten. So there aren't a lot of barriers in terms of what they can do and what they have experienced and the experience they bring to it and the confidence that they bring to it. I think that's a generation of, and men and women. I'm so proud of Chris Pappas, so honored to have him serving with us. And my colleagues are very excited to grow our, we call it HRC, the Human Rights Committee Caucus, but it's equality and it's about love the one you love, you know? And so anyway, they bring a great deal of energy and they bring a great deal of expertise in all different fields. And so having them come to Congress, some of them have gotten quite a bit of attention mm-hmm. and, you know, they've learned to communicate with the country in a way that goes outside of the standard, you know, print journalism. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who I've gotten to know. I've made a point of getting to know her.
Yeah, you've been photographed a lot with her, I feel like.
Well, I sat with her the day of our swearing in and sort of interpreted for her. She's 29 years old. She only started running for Congress a year ago. She didn't know a lot about the institution, and I was able to just sort of talk to her about, here's the history, here's who the people are, here's who the players are. And my feeling is I want to take these people under our wing, but I also want to learn from them. Mm-hmm. I went the day that she was talking about Twitter, and she communicates with 3 million people at the drop of a hat. That's a new force in our political process.
What do you mean when she was talking about Twitter? Did she teach you guys kind of the way that she uses social media?
Yeah, it was great. We had a little seminar on social media from Alexandria.
There you go.
And my colleague Jim Himes, who's my age, who does a lot on this. And, you know, we need to learn to change with the changing times, communicate with people in the way that they get their news and they express their opinions.
I'm glad you brought her up because she's an example, of course, of one of these people who seemingly is either trying to or is having some success with moving the party to the left. I mean, where would you chart yourself on this kind of arc of Democratic politics? If she's more on the left, I mean, are you more still in the middle, or where would you put yourself?
Well, there's a distinction here between my personal politics and my my district.
Okay.
Try to represent my district. And just to give you a sense of that, my district is 28% Democrat, mm-hmm. roughly 28% Republican, 44% undeclared independent, not interested in either party at this point, will vote the issue and the person. And so my district, some of them are very far to the left, and I try to engage with them and communicate with them, but most of them are not all the way out there to the left. So, for example, I am socially very progressive, very mm-hmm. pro-choice, pro-equality, all of those issues. And then there are other issues where I probably tend to be a little more oriented toward jobs, the economy, opportunity for all, thinking through the sort of pragmatic side. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, some of the issues that we have coming up, I've just gotten a big new committee assignment. I've had a great
energy and
6
commerce,
years yep. on Veterans Affairs, which I'm delighted that Chris Pappas will be taking my spot there. And I've had the opportunity to work on 2 different farm bills. They're 5 years apart, so I hit it year 1 and year 6 on the Ag Committee. And now I'm moving on to a big assignment, which is the Energy and Commerce Committee. Mm-hmm. We will do all of the renewable energy and climate change legislation and all of the healthcare legislation. And on both of those, we've got some bold ideas with a lot of enthusiasm at the grassroots behind them, the Green New Deal, the Medicare for All. And where I am is I'm going to be the practical, pragmatic, actually in the weeds working on the legislation. So, but I welcome the enthusiasm, and I welcome our party taking on big new ideas. I'm not objecting to that in any way. I think you need to drive to make progress, big progress, the Affordable Care Act, you know, making progress on saving our planet mm-hmm. and the climate. We need lots of enthusiasm at the grassroots. So I don't think it has to be an either-or proposition. Of course I want to save the planet. Of course I want universal health care for everyone. And then I'm in the weeds focused on how do we get from here to there? Huh. What is the practical reality of where we are? Going with the Green New Deal, and by the way, this was put together by lots of thoughtful people that have been working on it for a long, long time.
Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, exactly. As well as Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez.
And some of the brain power behind it. I've been in touch with a young man that I actually met in the primary back on the Obama campaign, Brandon Hurlbut. He worked his way up in the Department of Energy in the Obama administration. He's now working in the field of renewable energy. He was part of drafting it. So they connected with her, and she's helped them to lift a big idea. But it's interesting, the way they presented it, they actually presented it with just a handful of the renewables. They're very focused on solar. They're mm-hmm. very focused on wind. But the practical reality, just to use New Hampshire as an example, the power that we produce is 57% nuclear. Now, nuclear is carbon-free. And so if you want to reduce carbon pollution, that, for some people, is a carbon-free source that we should continue to use. And also the practical reality in New Hampshire, we probably will continue to have it. We need to stay focused on safety, and we need to, you know, make sure with this next licensing that we are safe. And then biomass is another example. Because I represent New Hampshire, because we have a lot of biomass, this is wood energy.
So that's something you'd be paying attention to.
It's something that I would be focused on. They didn't include it in their proposal. Right. So I think it's going to be a broader mix of energy sources.
I guess I just was curious because knowing your district, as you've explained it, and knowing you and your political history, I guess I just wondered if it felt like maybe the party is slowly shifting to the left around you, but it sounds like...
I think we're all in this together, and at the end of the day, what you're hearing right now is sort of the unfiltered, most enthusiastic, boldest ideas.
Loudest, right.
And at the end of the day, there will be the machinations of legislation. I mean, think of it this way. We can get things passed in the House because we're the majority, but in the Senate, you still have to deal with, you have to get to 60 votes to get past their cloture.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
That's a big deal. And by the way, to get anything done, it has to be signed into law by President Trump.
Right. So my next question would be
how... to work in a pragmatic way on bipartisan ideas. So sticking with the energy idea, I am a part of a Climate Solutions Caucus mm-hmm. that is bipartisan. Last session, we had 100 members. I don't know that we'll have that many Republicans because a lot of them sadly lost their seats. I mean, it's a good thing for us to have the majority, but you tend to pick off the most moderate Republicans that you can work with.
Right.
So we'll be working to find people on both sides of the aisle as we put our progressive ideas forward. And then in the Senate, it's the same. You know, I'm sure Senator Markey is casting about looking for Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins or people that he can work with, because it's not going to help anyone, and it's certainly not going to solve our climate crisis if we pass very bold legislation in the House that doesn't go anywhere in the Senate.
Because there wasn't much in there that it seemed like conservatives could really grasp onto in the Green New Deal specifically. Those are very, you know, progressive, quote-unquote, ideas.
It was aspirational. The way it was put forward was as a resolution. What I think the actual legislation will look like will be great for conservatives, for anybody. Everybody agrees that we need to build our economy. And what's great about renewable energy is it's a win-win-win. We can be less dependent on foreign oil. We can build our economy and create jobs. And, oh, by the way, we will save the planet. And that's the way I look at it, is let's, if we have to have our conversations with Republicans focused on jobs in their district and how to boost solar and wind and what kind of tax incentives that will take, then let's have that conversation.
Yeah, it seems like, going back to your point about the Senate and, you know, being controlled by Republicans, to the question I opened us up with, I mean, how much power can you guys really wield if, and this is a great example, you know, it almost doesn't matter at times how much you get in the House, unless do you find holes in the Republican Party that you can work
totally.
You can work with?
Absolutely, 100%. Most of the work that I get done, using opioids, for example, I created a bipartisan task force. We have 105 members, half R's, half D's, and we've been very successful at moving legislation and getting it to the president's desk and getting the funding out to communities. So I think that's the only way to get the job done. And I think that's the learning curve for my new colleagues, is for them to realize that it is not going to move the world forward if we only get things passed in the House, but they don't go anywhere in the Senate.
Right. And does that mean that you talk to them about how to compromise, or talk to them about how, you know, because I wonder sometimes about, I mean, there's countless investigations that are being opened up by House Democrats into whether it's the Russia investigation, the president's business dealings. You know, what's the balance that you have to strike with, you're investigating the president, that's obviously not making him or his allies very happy, but you also need to work with them. Is that something you're also talking to these new members
Absolutely.
About?
And I think this new step, it was a tragedy for the government to shut down for 5 weeks, and certainly the families that I met in New Hampshire without a paycheck, going to work at the TSA, not getting paid, that was very painful. But the outcome of that, of Republicans and Democrats coming together, passing a new budget, getting everybody on board, particularly where the president was not happy with the outcome, I think that was a really important moment for us as an institution to say, this is the role of Congress. We're going to deal with it in a responsible way, and the president will come along. And so I think that's the approach. And look, there are lots of issues that he talks about where we do have common ground. Reducing health care costs, particularly the price of prescription medication. I absolutely expect legislation to come out of my committee, to go to the floor, to pass the House, to pass the Senate, and for him to sign it into law. What I say over and over, he may take total credit. He'll have some big signing ceremony like he got it done, but it'll be better for the American people if the price of their medication is lower. The same for
infrastructure.
Infrastructure is the biggest one in terms of jobs and the economy. We talk about infrastructure, and we will definitely come forward with legislation out of our transportation committee, which, by the way, Chris Pappas now is going to be sitting on, which I'm very excited about. And we'll get that done. We'll get it to the Senate, and the Senate will get it to the president, and the president will sign it into law.
Well, that's Congresswoman Anne McClain Custer from the 2nd Congressional District in New Hampshire. Coming up, we're going to hear her positions on more of the big issues. We talked a bit about Green New Deal. We'll hear about the minimum wage and immigration. What questions do you have for her? We want you to call us, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. I'm Lauren Chulgen, filling in for Laura Kanoy. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Civics 101 has done hundreds of shows about how the government works.
But we realized that we missed a step, something bigger.
All right, step right up, gentlemen. Don't miss your chance to commit treason.
Our nation, our government, is all built on paper and ink.
That's why we made a 6-part series on the founding documents, the pieces of paper that make us us, or rather, we. Subscribe or listen online at civics101podcast.org. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen. Today we're hanging out with Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. She just kicked off her fourth term in Congress, and we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about her policy positions in Washington or maybe 2020, because that's all we ever talk about? Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call 1-800-892-6477. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So we got a lot of questions ahead of your visit, not surprisingly, about the president's national emergency declaration. And so, you know, he had made this declaration to free up billions of dollars for construction of the border wall between U.S. and Mexico. That, of course, was one of his big campaign promises. So you had tweeted pretty soon after that you didn't believe that there is an emergency at the border. So if not an emergency, how would you characterize our immigration situation in this country? Do you see it as a big problem or a crisis? I mean, how would you characterize it?
Well, it's interesting. The crisis is a man-made crisis, and I did take a trip to the border. Let me take you back to during the Obama administration. We did have people arriving at the border presenting themselves for asylum. Mm-hmm. They're typically fleeing from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. They're facing persecution. I took a trip down to the border, to McAllen, Texas. I was able to get in with a group of members of Congress into the transfer stations, if you will. It's a terrible word to use about people. They're mm-hmm. not cattle. They're individuals. They're human beings, but they're being kept in cages. You're in a big warehouse. The men and women are separated. The children are separated from their parents. It's tragic. And that is a tragedy. That we need to do better. And the reason that it's all backed up that way and why people are being held for days in those conditions is that there was a process that was being used during the Obama administration that was very, very successful. They would bring the people in, keep track of their information, give them a court date, and assign them to a person that would keep track of them. In some cases, they did use RFID. They used technology to keep track of them. Mm-hmm. In other cases, they just had a social worker that stayed in touch. Most of these people have family members here in America that they're going to go stay with. They have a plan. They have a roof over their head and a place to stay. And 6 weeks out, 8 weeks out, a couple of months out, they have a date and a hearing about their asylum claim. They had 98% of the people show up on time for those hearings. No questions, no problems. And the fact is, the American taxpayers did not have to pay three meals a day, roof over their head, medical care, or anything else. They were staying with family. Children were not traumatized by this experience. Families were not separated. The Trump administration made a change in that policy. And they are trying to discourage people from arriving at our shores and seeking asylum as refugees. And the reality is that they've created this problem. And the biggest issue was when they were separating families and children. I met a group of mothers whose children had been taken away from them. They had been told they needed to go to court, and children were not allowed in court. And they went to their court hearing, and the children were stolen. Taken by our government. I met two breastfeeding mothers whose babies were taken from them. It was tragic. So that's the crisis. That's a man-made crisis. Now, turning to immigration, mm-hmm. we do need comprehensive immigration reform. We have known about this for years. Kelly Ayotte voted for this 6 years ago. John McCain, Jean Shaheen, they voted for comprehensive immigration reform that passed in the Senate with a large margin. And the House did not take up one single bill.
And the counterargument,
Speaker John Boehner, Paul Ryan, we never took up a bill.
The counterargument that often comes in response to that is, well, Democrats have voted for a quote unquote wall before. So, you know, where's the middle ground that you see going forward?
I'm willing to listen to the experts. Mm-hmm. If they tell us that a barrier is helpful in an urban area, mm-hmm. then absolutely. We have 700 miles of barrier, and that appears to be working. What we don't need is 2,000 miles of some cement wall out in the middle of the desert or going over mountains. Listen to the experts about what's needed. So the other thing we need is a pathway to citizenship. We definitely need to take care of the Dreamers, and we have Republicans and Democrats that agree on that. These are young people brought to this country as children who are now employed or in school, participating in our community, contributing to our community. They should be given citizenship. And then we need to have a better process for asylum and go back to this process that had been working. So we would vote, and we will. The House will pass comprehensive immigration reform. I'm very confident of that. We have the majority. We'll send it to the Senate, and hopefully those very people that passed it the last time will agree, and we'll send it to the president. But this issue about the wall is he's using fear, and he's speaking only to his very narrow base. Here's the reality of it. Here in New Hampshire, where we have this opioid epidemic that's very serious, 90% of the illegal drugs coming into our country come through the ports of entry. What we need is to focus on 21st century border security at the ports of entry. And let me give a concrete example. There's a new technology, and I'm going to use the word X-ray so people can understand it. When a car drives by, they can see into the car.
Like an X-ray.
Where the drugs are hidden, mm-hmm. up under the wheel well. They take apart the car, they hide the drugs, they put the car back together. Only 6% of the cars coming through our border points are being screened that way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put the money there. These are precious tax dollars. Let's put the money into stopping the problem. Let's put the money into the United States Postal Service having the resources to screen the fentanyl that's coming in from China. It's not coming from Mexico. It's not coming over our southern border. And yet, the president's proposal under this emergency declaration, he's taking money out of the drug interdiction.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking money out of PEAS. He's taking money out of our National Guard here in Pembroke. This is impacting all across this country. He is taking money that was appropriated by Congress for other purposes in order to build this wall.
So in the interim then, you know, immigration reform aside, I mean, what can Congress do to act against, because obviously that's what you're hoping to happen, the National Emergency Declaration? I know Nancy Pelosi had sent out a letter last night saying that there would be a vote on a resolution.
Absolutely. And I'm signing on to that. It's going to be introduced this week.
But what kind of power will that have? I mean, we just talked at length about the Senate Republicans. It's got to go there next. What's the fate of something like this?
I think this process will be twofold. I think Congress will pass legislation to stop the president from expending these funds that have not been appropriated through Congress. And then I think this will ultimately go to the courts. 16 states have filed a court declaration that, and this is interesting, they've used something called the presentation clause, mm-hmm. which I do not recall from law school, but it's Article 1 with the Congress. This is the basic balance of powers in our country. And that's going back to the election in November. We are reasserting the balance of powers. The presentation clause is that in order for the White House to spend money, mm-hmm. our precious tax dollars, it has to be authorized and appropriated by Congress. In this case, the money that was agreed upon by Republicans and Democrats in Congress was for 21st century border security, 55 miles of fencing, but that was it. And he's trying to circumvent the process under our Constitution, and I believe the courts will stop that.
And so one last question before we move to a new topic. I saw you and your congressional colleagues had signed off on a letter that opposed reallocating funding for construction at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and putting it toward the wall. I mean, is that an actual possibility?
That's what they're proposing.
And what could you do to stop that?
That both the legislation and the litigation
would be able to do that. Yeah.
Ultimately,
like that.
I would expect it will be the United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
But when you think about that, Congress appropriated the funds. It's a submarine project,
mm-hmm.
and it's a big deal for New Hampshire and the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard that we are. And I misspoke when I said peace. I meant the shipyard.
Okay. Right.
it's a big project that is about our collective defense. In the wisdom of the Armed Services Committee in the House and the Senate, with expert testimony, they have chosen this technology of new submarines. They're going to be built here. And now the president is saying, with his magic wand, he's going to take that money and expend it on a wall down on the border. And that's not what was intended by our Constitution, by our framers.
Well, this will certainly be an ongoing issue that you'll be dealing with. And so if you have questions...
Absolutely. We're all getting a lesson in civics and in civics, the Constitution, yeah, for sure.
So give us a call if you want to join our conversation with Congresswoman Annie McLean Custer. The number to dial is 1-800-892-6477. You can also leave us a note on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange, or email us exchange@nhpr.org. And we do actually have a call right now from Bo. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
What's your question for the Congresswoman?
I'm really concerned about, and I don't hear anybody talking about, the lack of antitrust enforcement in the drug industry. It's resulted in artificially high prices for medications, and most recently it has resulted in critical shortages of life-saving drugs. I worked in a cardiac hospital. And, you know, we were telling the doctors on a weekly basis, oh, you know, we can't get this thing that you need and have been using, you know, routinely for something. And this is what you have for a backup. And it's not very good. But I don't hear anybody talking about enforcing the antitrust laws to stop the drug manufacturers from continuing their monopoly after their patent expires.
Great, Paul.
And from acquiring other generic manufacturers so they can drive the price up of drugs that have been around forever.
Well, thanks so much, right, Paul, for the call. Go ahead.
No, thank you very much, Paul. And this is one of the top issues that we'll be dealing with, this Energy and Commerce Committee that does all of healthcare, and in particular will be very focused on prescription drugs, and we'll start those hearings soon. Just to give an example that hits home here in New Hampshire, everybody's become familiar with Narcan, which is the sort of familiar name of a drug called naloxone. And that's the one that reverses the impact of a drug overdose and literally saves lives. The price of that drug has gone up 600% as this very moment in this crisis, when every fire station, every police chief, even families want that to be available and have it in their home. So I couldn't agree with you more, Paul. I'm interested in your idea about the antitrust, because I think what you're referring to, there are monopoly situations with certain medications where only one company has the patent, has the research and the technology to discover that particular treatment. And then it takes a period of time before it comes off and is available in generic form. And what Paul's referring to is there's been manipulation of that process, where they'll delay the process or they'll buy up the company that wants to bake it in generic form and to try to maintain their monopoly. And I agree with you that we could do this through the antitrust. I doubt that the Trump administration will be focused on that in the Justice Department, but I think it's an interesting perspective for us legislatively to be focused on. We're also going to be looking, my number one goal is to get competition, increased competition, particularly Medicare Part D. This was a political issue back in the George Bush years, George W. Bush, when Congress, frankly, was under the influence of the pharmaceutical companies and made the decision not to get a volume discount under Medicare Part D. That was a tragic mistake that we need to turn around, and I expect we will pass legislation shortly that we will get the volume discount so that the taxpayers and seniors don't pay for higher costs for medication. If you look at Walmart or Walgreens, that's why the medication is less expensive, is they negotiate lower prices. But we're also going to be looking at purchasing drugs across borders. For example, Canada. I know a lot of people in New Hampshire do that. We're going to be looking at the prices in other countries and why they're lower and why it's more expensive here. So this is going to be a big focus for us.
Yeah, and let's stick with healthcare because that's obviously going to be a big issue. We have a call from Lori in Grantham. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
What's
Hi.
Your question for the Congresswoman?
Well, my question is I work for home health and hospice as an LNA, and I find that so many seniors can't afford the care that they need to stay home. And, you know, the cost is outrageous for them to have home health care, where it would be so much more economical for them to stay at home than to be in a facility.
Mm-hmm.
I had my own situation with my mother where she was on hospice care, and I moved here from Oregon just to take care of my mother and for her to move in with me. And I was able to do that because I am an LNA. But so many families aren't equipped to take care of their loved ones, and the cost is so ridiculously high. I'm just wondering, you know, what could be in store for seniors in our community and how we can make it more economical for them.
Great. Thanks for the call, Lori.
Absolutely, Lori, and thank you. Welcome to New Hampshire. Thank you for coming to take care of your mother. I want to commend you. First of all, LNAs are such an important part of the healthcare delivery system, and it's something that we're focused on to try to make sure that we educate enough people to become LNAs and then nursing, you know, work their way up in terms of their education and their value and their wages for their family. This is sort of a catch-22 because I also want to make sure that they're paid sufficiently for doing home health care and hospice. I am very focused on that. This is something that I believe in to my core. My mother had Alzheimer's disease for the last 5 years of her life.
And wrote a book about it.
And we wrote a book together about her political career, mm-hmm. former Senator Susan McClain. But also the idea that it is so much more cost effective for our society to keep people at home as long as we can. And I want to make sure that Medicare, Medicaid are incentivized that way, because to be in institutional care, and by the way, we were blessed. She was at Havenwood for the last year of her life, and the quality of care was outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so much more expensive to have, you know, 24/7 shifts, to have the capital improvements and all that go with institutional care, as compared to helping families keep her at home with home health and hospice.
We got a lot of questions about health care, and a lot of people wanted to know if you support Medicare for All.
And that's the big question, absolutely.
The big
Look,
question.
Here's the answer. I absolutely support universal health care for everyone in America. That's my goal.
And
I think
that
that's
mean?
The goal of the people that are supporting Medicare for All. They've latched onto that as if that is the solution. It's one of the solutions that we're going to be considering in our committee. And one way to approach that, I think, is for us, and I've signed on to legislation that would give people a public option on the exchange, on the Obamacare exchange, for Medicare at age 50. So between 50 and 65, you could buy into Medicare. You would pay a premium, but you'd be getting the same quality of care, the same type of care. Most people on Medicare are very satisfied with the quality of their care. And my view of this is that, and by the way, I appreciate the enthusiasm behind the Medicare for All.
Yeah, what is it you don't like about it?
I just don't think it's practical reality. There's not a switch in Washington where we can completely change over the entire system in one fell swoop. And I think if we do this as sort of a pilot project, we can demonstrate whether it works, if it works, if people are satisfied, and then keep working the age down to the point where it is Medicare for All. Or another approach that I've heard, and I've also signed on to this legislation, is a Medicaid option that you can buy in. That way you could bring your family into it. We would need to improve the rates to make sure that we have everyone in the process. That one's a little more flexible in terms of the state role and the states being able to focus, for example, here in New Hampshire, on access to mental health and opioid treatment. So there are lots of different processes to get from here to there, but I share the goal of universal health care for everyone, and I want to make sure that we can cope with the practical reality of how we get there.
Mm-hmm. Another question we heard a lot about a lot is marijuana legalization. I mean, this debate is ongoing at the State House right now. The governor has said he's not interested in legalizing any more drugs because of the opioid crisis. Senator Jeanne Shaheen has expressed some concerns. I believe Senator Hassan is against it. Where are you on legalizing marijuana?
And I have concerns as well. I do. I'm very interested in watching the states as a model for that. One thing I will say, at the federal level, we absolutely should get rid of the prohibition on research,
okay,
because I want to see the research. I want to see that in these states they've been able to manage addiction, that they've been able to manage some of the criminal elements that come along with it. I think this is becoming big, big business. I expect the tobacco industry to get right into marijuana sales. Look, I heard one of the candidates say it's joy. And for people that this brings them joy, we've decriminalized small amounts in New Hampshire. We have medical marijuana for people who say that this is an option for them in their treatment of nausea. But I also am very well aware, people in my family, people who I've grown up with and known, who had less joyful experiences, mm-hmm, with addiction, substance use disorder. And so until we have scientific evidence that can back up the fact that this is not going to add to people's challenges here in New Hampshire, I'm cautious, but I'm also very much willing to...
So you're like a no-ish.
Yeah,
like.
I mean, I'm willing to let the state legislature sort that out for the community. I think it's an issue that should be closest to the people so that people can come forward and say how they feel. But I'm undecided, weighing the balances, and I'm always interested to hear from people about their views.
Well, coming up, Congresswoman Custer's been spotted with many 2020 hopefuls who have already dropped by the Granite State. We'll hear her take on the already packed Democratic primary, and it's still only February, so there's much more time for many more to join us. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgin, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Tons of presidential hopefuls were in town last weekend. We'll have a panel tackling all the news and more with 2020. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're talking with Congresswoman Annie McLean Custer. We'd love for you to join our conversation. Email your questions to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And the number, of course, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. All right. Well, speaking of 2020, I mean, you've been out and about. You've been spotted with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, you were with Kamala Harris, you've Sherrod Brown too, I think. I mean, so how
and
do you
Cory
pick
Booker.
And Cory Booker? Don't want to leave anybody out. How do you pick and choose who to see when they come here? And are there ever any concerns about appearing with someone? It could look like an endorsement.
Well, I'm not endorsing yet, and
okay,
I'm making that very, very clear.
Okay.
My role and my goal here is to make everyone feel kindly welcome, to use a Shaker expression.
Kindly welcome.
And that I want the New Hampshire primary to be a very welcoming place for all of these candidates.
Mm-hmm.
It's great practice for them. It's a great experience for them to be this close to people who are very savvy about this choice, by the way. We've gone through this a number of times, and the questions are going to be tough, and they're going to be pointed, and they're going to elicit their responses. And I know that we're going to improve them as candidates, and the strongest candidates will move forward to the other primaries and the other caucuses around the country.
So you feel like New Hampshire still has the, you know, that mythical power that we've always said that it has?
Absolutely, and we're not right every time, let's face it.
Right.
But I think what we do is we improve the quality of the candidates that come out of New Hampshire, and we give them that retail politic experience. We give them the small house party, the small town hall, we've seen most of these candidates now at Gibson's Bookstore right here in Concord. And we give them the big rallies. I was up at Dartmouth with Cory Booker and there with Kirsten Gillibrand and, you know, 200 or 300 students, and how do they perform in front of a larger audience. And we give them the range of views. We just had a conversation about my district.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them come from deep blue districts where they can say anything. And
right.
and they are. You know, they're all over it. All of these issues, Green New Deal, Medicare for All.
They're not getting the pushback from the other
you know,
party.
Legalized marijuana.
Right.
Like, they're right out there with all of this. And that's great where they live, but let them come to New Hampshire and put that out there and let's see where people are in this primary season. And it gives them more of a sense, I think particularly our large group of independent voters, because we call them independent, but most of them have a history of voting Democrat
right.
or have a history of voting Republican or go back and forth between candidates. So I talk to people all the time who were great John McCain supporters, but then they turned around and supported, you know, a Democrat. And so I think they'll get exposure to a lot of points of views and they'll get exposure to important issues. The opioid epidemic was a big issue
in 2016.
Right. And that was because of the conversations they had here in New Hampshire.
And so as far as your welcoming role, I mean, are candidates calling your cell phone and saying, what do I need to know? Who's calling you? And what do they ask when they call?
I will say this. This is a vain moment. I literally took a screenshot because I was having dinner a couple of weeks ago with some friends. And first I had to take a break to Kirsten Gillibrand. I called. We talked for 20 minutes about her trip coming up. Where should she go? Who should she see? I came back to the table. Then Kamala called and I took that call. And then on the way home, Cory Booker called.
In the same dinner?
It's just one screenshot of my phone.
What do they ask?
They want to know how to do this. I've won elections here. You know, where should they go? Who should they see? What are the types of experiences that are very New Hampshire? Their questions have been great. I talked to Sherrod Brown and for half an hour. You know, I mean, they want to understand. They're coming into my district and my state. I've lived here my whole life. I've been on presidentials my whole life. I was the second person to get on board with Barack Obama
right.
when we were still spelling his name. And so they want to know, how did he get that done? And it's very grassroots. He started out in living rooms just like everyone else. I can remember the very first event that Michelle did here at Ned and Sally Helms in Concord. And I remember, you know, now we think of Michelle Obama and so poised and, you know, just handles herself so gracefully and she's so smart. And I remember that first speech where she was talking about her personal life for the first time. And, you know, there were some issues and we worked on it and she worked over her her bio and how she talked about Barack. And so it's fun. It's really interesting. And I just welcome your listeners to be a part of it because it's an extraordinary experience. My first presidential, I was 16 years old, and that's what led me on this path to where I am now.
We've talked a lot this hour about party dynamics, and I wonder if you, as a Democrat, get concerned at all, you know, as the field gets larger and larger, it's difficult to unite a party when there's all these different ideas, when it becomes competitive. Are you concerned about, you know, the party's health, so to speak?
I always worry about that a little bit. I mean, we still have Howard Dean supporters, you know, and Bernie supporters and Hillary supporters. And we've dealt with this over the years. Again, I feel as though my role is to help to bring the party back together here in New Hampshire. And I'm happy to play a role with that nationally, that we are one big party. We do share the values of universal health care, of saving the planet, of recognizing the dignity of every person. We haven't talked about campaign finance reform, but
yes.
Our HR1 is for the people. Give the government back to the people on voting rights and campaign finance reform and making sure that every vote counts and that your voice will be heard. These are values that we share across the spectrum. And I think what's important, and again, this is what I want to convey to the candidates coming to New Hampshire, we will treat you respectfully and we want to be heard. We want our voice to be heard.
Well, in the remaining minutes we have left, I wanted to take a quick break from politics and talk about Dartmouth, your alma mater. Obviously, they're dealing, as you know, with this federal lawsuit over allegations the school repeatedly mishandled sexual misconduct complaints in the psychological and brain sciences department. I mean, you've been very open with your story about an experience that you had when you were a student there, that you were assaulted. I want to know, though, I mean, How deep does this problem go, do you think, at the college? I mean, it's been so many years since you went there, and we're still talking about it. There was a letter that came out. Our colleague Breida Green had a great story about it, that there were like 500 students and alumni that said that they believe there's a long-running institutional culture there that minimizes and disregards sexual violence. I mean, that's obviously a huge problem. Do you feel that that exists there?
I do, and it's heartbreaking for me. I love the college, and I still, my closest friends, my college roommate came up for the lunch with Cory Booker. I mean, my sons both went there. My father went there. My mother grew up there. So I don't think it's unique. I'm not make this as an excuse. I think it's to understand the scope of the problem. Mm-hmm. We saw with Chessie Prout, and I want to give her a shout out for her courage dealing with St. Paul's School, long, long history, 40 years ago when they went co-ed.
Right.
All of these schools. But I do think at Dartmouth there's a particular culture, and I am shocked that this is going on 40 years later. I went there when I was 18, coming mm-hmm. out of Concord High School. I was in the third class of women. I was very aware.
And that transition
that
was time. Difficult for
that
the
school. Transition was very difficult. And I paid a personal price for that I never spoke about for 40 years until I told the story a few years ago on the floor of the U.S. Congress and shared it with everyone. I think we need to change, and I've had conversations with Phil Hanlon, mm-hmm. the president, because it needs to come from the top. We've talked about change over the years as though the students would do this on their own, but we haven't had the leadership and the commitment of change throughout the institution.
Well, that's Congresswoman Annie McLean Custer. We so appreciate you coming and spending an hour with us while you're back home this morning.
This has been great, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Oh, anytime. Well, next Monday, Senator Jean Shaheen will be here for the full show. You can send your questions for her to exchange at nhpr.org, or you can post on Facebook at NHPR Exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Alan Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our couch fellow is Ali Oshinsky. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Lauren Chulgen. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, everybody.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.